Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back tomorrow. Coming up, we'll talk to a public health expert about how the new Wisconsin Health Trends report shows some promising news for the Badger State and also shows some areas where we need to improve health outcomes in the state. First, government selling public parkland can be a controversial topic. That's the case with a proposal headed for a vote tomorrow in Milwaukee County. The county wants to sell a 7-acre park near Lake Michigan to one of the biggest companies in the state, a firm that for years stayed out of the headlines and liked to get things done quietly. Chuck Kornbach reports.
Decades ago, Northwestern Mutual called itself the Quiet Company. In 1980, they ran a television ad that began to alter that image.
There comes a time to be recognized, for Northwestern Mutual Life can no longer be just the Quiet Company.
Nowadays, the firm, also known by its initials, NM, is making lots of noise. That's the sound of a new NM office tower being put up on the north side of Wisconsin Avenue in Milwaukee. Just across the street is the county-owned O'Donnell Park, which has a parking garage, pavilion, and a plaza with a view of Lake Michigan. Northwestern Mutual wants to buy the park for about $14 million. But park supporters are not quietly accepting the deal.
This is Lynn and Bob Slater, love from your children and grandchildren.
Virginia Small reads the inscription on one of the bricks on the plaza. Private sponsors of bricks and public tax dollars paid for the park about 25 years ago. Small is concerned what'll happen to the bricks if Northwestern Mutual buys the place. Another park backer, Barbara Aho, wonders what'll happen to the park's layout.
There's lots of native plants, trees, and it's really very sensitively designed and beautifully designed.
Northwestern Mutual Vice President Sandy Botcher says public access would not be lost and the company would spend millions more dollars to spruce up the parking garage and plaza.
If we don't get this space, we will build parking somewhere else, but O'Donnell will continue to be exactly what it is today, a place that is underutilized and in need of repair, and that will be a loss for all of the community.
The Milwaukee County Board is about to decide on the O'Donnell plan, and the vote may be close. Some board members say they flat out oppose selling parkland, worried that eventually the park will disappear. Others, like Supervisor Patricia Jersic, say the $14 million price tag is far too low, and she'd like to amend the proposal. But because Governor Scott Walker signed a law last year that reduced power for the county board and gave it to the Milwaukee County Executive, Jersic says the board only gets an up or down vote.
We really cannot in any way try to amend what many of us see as an extremely bad deal.
But County Executive Chris Abley says selling O'Donnell Park to Northwestern Mutual would be a good deal, generating $5 million to be put into other parks. He argues that all other Wisconsin counties already give the county's top official sole negotiating power.
I know there's this link to say this is all Walker. It's not that. It's just about the way, you know, a legislative branch and executive branch usually works.
The fight over O'Donnell Park could preview other state and national battles if fiscal conservatives try to sell more public land. Mike Carlson of the Madison-based Land Trust Alliance Gathering Waters says one thing politicians should remember is that almost every property is special to someone.
People really do have these really strong affinities and strong connections to individual parcels and have, you know, a really strong sense of place.
And that's what some in Milwaukee say they have for O'Donnell Park. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now we're taking a look at a report out yesterday from the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. It's a look at health trends in Wisconsin. And while there's clearly progress in some areas of state health, those good outcomes aren't shared equally by all Wisconsin residents. Dr. Patrick Remington is here to break down the report for us. It's called 2014 Wisconsin Health Trends. Patrick Remington is a professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences in the School of Medicine and Public Health at UW-Madison. Pat, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's start with the good news. What positive health trends are we seeing in Wisconsin over the last 10 years or so?
Well, one of the most important measures of the health of a community is how long people live. And we use a measure called the premature death rate. measures the number of years of life lost before the age of 75. But the bottom line is that number's going in the right direction. People, on average, are living longer as time goes on, and that comes from saving lives of young kids, saving lives of teenagers and young adults, as well as older adults.
So premature death rate is declining in Wisconsin.
That's a good thing. That's right.
And what about when we look at things like smoking and drinking?
Well, those are two different measures. Fortunately, smoking has been going down for the past two decades. Some of the policies we put in place in the 1980s and 90s have now gotten good return on that investment. Increasing the cigarette excise tax not only drove down demand for smoking, but also increased resources for prevention services and prevention programs. Also, clean indoor air policies were tremendously successful, not just in changing the norm from a you can smoke anywhere norm to a norm where you expect air to be clear and free of cigarette smoke, but also supported policies to clean the air, clear the air, so people are breathing less smoke from other individuals. Binge drinking, we've ranked number one in the state, in the nation, not in a good way, in a bad way, and having the highest rates of binge drinking ever since these surveys were done. The good news is that measure is going down slightly, but we certainly have a long way to go by reducing that number further.
And finally, to take another aspect of this, teen birth. What do we know there?
Well, we know that teen births are preventable. There are evidence-based programs, educational programs, and programs that can be done in schools and in communities that work. And the good news is that teen births are going in the right direction. We're seeing fewer teen births, meaning less unintended or unplanned pregnancies. We should remember, though, for teen births and for all of these statistics, that this state has tremendous disparities in these rates, not just by income or race, but also by where you live. So I encourage people to go onto the website of the Population Health Institute to download the report, and you can see these numbers not only for the whole state, but for where you live in specific subpopulations.
So that's all good news that we've been talking about so far. There is another aspect to this, and that is that these positive trends aren't really being experienced equally by everyone in the state of Wisconsin. What have we seen where there are some gaps in health outcomes?
Well, it's surprising. Binge drinking is perhaps the only risk behavior that is regularly higher in whites than in African Americans. It seems to be a behavior that young white males particularly engage in. But many of the other behaviors, such as cigarette smoking and rates of obesity related to unhealthy eating and insufficient exercise, are higher in populations that are predominantly affected by poverty or lack of education. And we see this particularly in our underrepresented minorities in the state. So if you look, it is important to follow the summary measures, the overall measure in a state. We really hope that we're moving in the right direction on all of these important health factors. But it's also important to follow each of the groups by where people live, by the characteristics that define a subgroup in the population, to make sure that everybody's sharing equally in the progress or the advances that are being made.
Now, in terms of pinpointing some of the subgroups, you mentioned income and geographic region. Can you put your finger on geographic regions of the state that need some help when it comes to health?
Well, certainly. And one of the programs the Population Health Institute started is the County Health Rankings. This not only ranks the health of the counties, but it also provides a snapshot for every county in our state. So you can see many, if not all of these indicators. We see overall that the northern counties, particularly the counties bordering the Upper Peninsula, counties in the center part of the state surrounding Mauston and Juneau and Adams County, and then counties in the southeastern part of the state, particularly the urban center of Milwaukee, have health outcomes that are not as good and health risks that are more challenging. You see the suburbs of Milwaukee, Madison, Dane County, some of the Fox River Valley communities, and the counties adjacent to the Twin Cities fare very well in the outcomes, as well as those factors that can contribute to good health.
Now, Wisconsin has been in the news quite a bit lately, in particular Milwaukee, for having disparities when it comes to race. Do you see that same sort of scenario showing up when you look at health outcomes for African Americans in Wisconsin?
Yes, you do. And it's not just Milwaukee. I think the important finding that we see with health outcomes for blacks in particular is that disparities exist no matter where you are in the state. Dane County, for example, has some of the highest disparities in health and in other determinants, things that affect health, like education, compared to anywhere in the country. I've been studying and following these numbers for many years, and it's been remarkable to me that to be a black in Wisconsin means that you are disproportionately affected by some of the greatest burdens, by some of the greatest economic, social factors, and also health outcomes. We don't really know why that is. We don't understand what it is about life in Wisconsin or in some of Wisconsin's community that makes it particularly challenging for African Americans, but we certainly know it's a problem and need to continue the conversation and really get at the root causes.
We're talking right now with Dr. Patrick Remington of the UW Population Health Institute about the state of health in Wisconsin, and we'd like to hear from you on this. Are you surprised to hear that Wisconsin is doing so well in some health areas, including rates of smoking, some declines in binge drinking? Does this report match with what's happening in your community? And when you see disparities and you hear about them, as Dr. Remington is telling us now, does that match also what you may be seeing in your community? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion about the state of Wisconsin's health with Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW Population Health Institute. And we're taking your calls. Why do you think there are health gaps for different racial groups in Wisconsin and also varied by income and geographic region? What do you think can be done to close those gaps? And what's being done in your community to promote better health? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Now, we were talking about the racial gap when it comes to good health here in Wisconsin. And let's look at some of those other factors you mentioned. You mentioned income, and we talked a little about geography. So let's start with income. What do we know about how income plays into all of this in terms of health?
Well, in public health, we've traditionally focused on things like health behaviors and more of the traditional risk factors. And what research has shown, and actually people understand pretty well, is that those health behaviors like smoking or not getting enough exercise or eating a unhealthy diet are actually the outcomes or the results of other factors that we now call social and economic determinants, or the social causes of health problems. And we've begun to refocus the aim. Not that we're ignoring programs that help people quit smoking or give advice on how to eat or exercise, but we've also directed the conversation toward those root causes. We also use the metaphor of thinking about a stream, where today's problems are really thought of as drowning in the river, but there's some things that go on upstream, further upstream in the metaphor or back in time in one's life. Things like early childhood trauma, growing up in poverty as a child, dropping out of high school, or really being challenged socially or economically. And those factors then increase your risk of unhealthy behaviors, increase your risk of not having the opportunity to get a job and have health insurance, for example. And then it's those factors that are really the mechanisms of poor health. So if you're going to think about a healthy community, you have to not only think about the health behaviors and the things that people get in their healthcare system, but also about the root causes and the upstream factors. And how can we invest in those so that maybe the healthcare system doesn't necessarily spend money on good childhood education or early childhood education or health literacy, but the community should, so that people really grow and develop in as healthy environment as they can.
And that must require a lot of cooperation. You're talking about looking at health as maybe part of the end game, or at least part of the big picture, but you have to collaborate with people to talk about some of those things that are happening, as you say, further upstream. Is that hard to get different entities to talk to each other and come together to find holistic solutions to things that initially may seem unrelated?
Well, that's a great question. And yes, I think traditionally that healthcare has operated in a sort of hierarchical command center. Certainly, if you have a urgent health problem, you want a person who's in charge and really leading from the front. But to get communities to work together, different styles of leadership are needed. Partnerships are an important term now in public health. It's no longer about simply providing services to those who need it. It's about developing partnerships. In fact, in the School of Medicine and Public Health, we have a program called the Wisconsin Partnership Program. The idea is that it's an endowment. It can provide grants to communities, but it also strives to develop better partnerships between people who are working in communities and between university faculty who might be researching and studying those problems. So absolutely, partnerships are an essential thread that really goes throughout all of our work.
So to follow this thread for just a moment, to take a childhood trauma, you said, can influence health outcomes later in life. Can you give us an example of how you might intervene earlier to try to prevent childhood trauma, which would down the road prevent poor health at an older age?
Well, much of the research has looked at what are called the adverse child experiences, growing up in a home that where you may have abuse or neglect. Even parental divorce has been shown to be a traumatic event for children. And not that every divorce ends in a trauma for kids, but that the risk is increased. And interventions that might not be considered healthcare interventions should focus on those young children to provide an environment where they can thrive. So people talk about nurse home visiting as a not only cost-effective but really proven program that can help people who are challenged, perhaps a single parent or a parent or a family that's living in poverty. Also programs in early childhood education. We know when we invest in early childhood education that you see the returns. Kids come to school ready to learn, and then once they're ready to learn, they can achieve good educational outcomes and have a better health down the road. So it's really, again, not only thinking about length and quality of life, but it's also important to think about those factors that contribute to that. And some of them are very direct, helping people manage their diabetes or quit smoking. But others are really more investments in society and understanding that those have not just a societal benefit, but really a health benefit, that you'll lead to healthier populations with less disparity if you invest early in life and in the communities that really need it the most.
When you make those interventions earlier on, those investments in health for down the road, how soon do you generally see a return? Is it sometimes hard to conceptualize because you may not see the return until you've got young adults on your hand, or is it something that can turn around quite quickly?
Well, I think that's the real challenge, is that research has demonstrated convincingly that these investments do return on the dollar, sometimes even $5 or $10 for every dollar invested. But many of those returns come later in life. And so it's hard for people to invest in a family or in a child when the savings are going to accrue down the road. But we really have to be smart about it. If we don't invest in early life course or in prevention, we will be paying the higher costs later on. But it's sometimes not a savings that you see right away.
In terms of education and how that relates to health, what have you seen in your report?
Well, the educational disparities actually are some of the strongest we see. In fact, many of the racial disparities we see, when you look across the same education groups, the racial disparities are diminished, sometimes even go away. So that smoking rates, for example, women who give birth, smoking rates are 10 times higher among women who give birth without a high school education compared to people with graduate or college degrees. That's 30 to 40% smoking rates compared to 3 or 4%. imagine how hard it is for the children in those families to begin life working in a household where a parent smokes, exposed to passive smoke. The only difference in that household is the rate of smoking related to the education of the mother and the parents.
So taking your report as a whole, it's a complex report. There's some good news, there's some bad news, there's different ways to interpret this and different ways to move forward. Briefly here, what do you hope people take away from this report?
Well, first of all, that health is more than health care. That what determines the health of individuals and the health of communities comes from the social and economic factors in your community, education, ability to get a good job, and that we need to consider diverse investments, not just in treatment programs, but in programs that are upstream. The second thing is you can find this report online. I assume it's going to be posted on the WPR website.
We'll have it up on the Central Time Facebook page as well.
That's great. And then there is the county health rankings. If you look at countyhealthrankings.org, you can click on your county and see a snapshot that shows all of the variables for where you live in Wisconsin.
Well, Patrick, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Dr. Patrick Remington, professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences in the School of Medicine and Public Health at UW-Madison. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin is the country's largest producer of cranberries, and most of those are grown in the North Woods. Emily Bright visited one of those cranberry marshes before the harvest in August, where she met a military veteran turned cranberry grower. She found out what it's like to have your world revolve around this holiday favorite.
Benjamin Riker served two tours with the Wisconsin National Guard. When he returned home from Iraq in 2009,
I was at a crossroads where, you know, we didn't know what we wanted to do as a family. I ended up getting a job offer from my dad, who owns the marsh.
Ben Riker is now assistant manager of the James Lake Farm in Three Lakes. Growing cranberries in northern Wisconsin is a far cry from detainee operations in Iraq. Riker had worked at a cranberry marsh before, but he says military duty imparts certain outlooks that transfer elsewhere, like being aware of your surroundings, working at a fast pace, and above all, keeping the big picture in mind. You learn to appreciate a civilian work environment.
We are looking at a bunch of halfway ripe cranberries, picturesque green tree lines that haven't changed into autumn colors yet.
It's late August, the day Riker drives me in his truck along the dike between cranberry beds. There's been a surge of wildlife since the marsh turned organic in 2007. A flock of geese waddles around, munching on bugs.
And then you kind of can measure time by when the birds come in or when turtles pop their heads up and muskrats start running around. You see the geese, and before you know it, there's one pair with four, six, or eight goslings running around.
Already the warm days and cold nights are helping the berries turn from white to red.
Look at this one. You can see that the leaf print is just hanging right on it. And it's staying warm from the leaf, and it's also, you know, getting shaded from the leaf. We got a long ways to go.
Riker and his young family live on the marsh, and like any farmer, his calendar year revolves around the growing season. Tonight, Riker is on frost watch.
We've got a couple probes that sit in the beds, and those probes are hooked up to a transmitter, and we have receivers in our bedrooms. Very loud, more annoying than the wah-wah alarm clock. Way more annoying than that. You wake up, you go turn on the pumps, and that's how you frost protect.
The cranberries they harvest are sold as fresh fruit around the state and as grade 4 concentrate to make products like juice, facial scrubs, vitamins, and baby food.
Do you look at food differently? How so?
Yeah, at lunch, I was eating one of the carrots from the garden. You just look at it, and you just wonder, who was the first person to test this out to make sure it was consumable? How did that happen?
There are so many variables when it comes to growing food that keeping the big picture in mind is key. Riker says sometimes you just have to trust Mother Nature.
Mother Nature kind of keeps everything on track, even though we had a longer winter. We still got fruit, and it still is going to be a decent harvest.
Another mentality that comes from military service, Riker says, is learning to take things with a certain amount of levity when you can. Numbers were a little low this year, and the hectic weeks of cranberry harvest finished up earlier than anticipated. Riker welcomes working at a calmer pace as they get the beds ready for winter slumber. The cycle begins again next spring.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org. Ever since a white police officer shot an unarmed black teen in Missouri 4 months ago, the word Ferguson has become synonymous with issues of racial justice. But Ferguson also opened up a broader debate about African Americans' interaction with the criminal justice system, conversation which has spilled into Wisconsin, where the incarceration rate for black men at 13% is nearly double the national rate. Protests have spread across the country, including here in Wisconsin, one on the UW-Madison campus, held with hundreds of UW-Madison students, where they staged a march and a die-in. The UW-Madison is hosting a panel discussion tonight looking at Ferguson in context with issues of trauma, violence, and citizenship. William Jones will be part of that conversation that's being held this evening at 5:30 p.m. at the Discovery Building. Will Jones is a professor of history at the UW-Madison and the author of The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights. Will, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
And also with us is Deshaun McKinney, a UW student and organizer of the recent Black Lives Matter protest on the UW campus. Deshaun, thank you for coming and being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Deshaun, you organized the Sunday protests on the UW-Madison campus in which hundreds of students participated, and you did this during finals. Why was this moment so important to you as a political organizer?
You mean to do it during finals week?
Right now, to take that moment, you were busy, you had a lot going on. What's important to you about this moment?
Well, I think it was important to leave for break on this note, because everybody's going to be away from campus for a month, and a lot of people on this campus won't have to confront these issues when they're at home and when they're away, so it'd be really easy for them to forget that this is happening. A lot of people will leave and forget that Black death is still a reality around the nation and that racism and injustice still happened on this very campus. So I think it was really important to plant that seed in people's minds. And also for a lot of the people who supported and or participated, it was important to just plant that seed that we are starting this movement and that we are working towards change on this campus. And it gave a lot of people hope, and we can come back and hit the ground running.
And what kind of change would you like to see on the campus?
Well, I think what we all want is just to feel like we belong. You know, a lot of people, I've been hearing that Sunday was the first time that they felt proud to call themselves a Badger or an alum. And that's coming from a lot of people who have been here for years, people who are graduating, you know. So I think that's also really beautiful and really heartbreaking at the same time. So we just want to a campus that's more inclusive and that just accepts everybody, that's actually inclusive and not just toting the word around like as a buzzword. So that's the change that we want to see.
And Will, you're the author of The March on Washington, a book that highlights the forgotten history of the civil rights. Looking at it through that lens and the gains of the civil rights era, what do you make of the situation right now post-Ferguson and the movement we're seeing, Deshaun's a part of it, that is trying to open the conversation and build toward real inclusivity?
Yeah, I guess I feel in this past couple of weeks really torn between a really intense feeling of elation and optimism and a sense of dismay and skepticism. I think the optimism comes from seeing things like the protests that Deshaun helped to organize, things like that happening across the country. I think a really serious, you know, the note that you started on, a really serious conversation about things that have been happening in this country for a long time, but have not gained the kind of attention that I think a lot of people across the country are giving it to them really rightly. I guess I'm balancing that sense of that we're in a new moment with what I know as a historian, which is a really long and in some ways unbroken history of this type of racist violence and hyper policing toward African Americans, particularly young black men. I'm actually drawn in my own experience back to when I was a senior in college in 1992. I participated in mass demonstrations that followed the circulation of video of Rodney King being beaten on the Los Angeles freeway. And I think for me and for many of the people that I was in school with, that was a moment of sort of realization of a long-standing problem. After the officers that were seen on video beating Rodney King were acquitted of all their charges,
Riots broke out around the country. We had it became the center of a debate in a presidential race. President Clinton, who was elected in the months following those riots, called for a national conversation around race and particularly about police brutality and these issues. And so here we are, you know, now I'm a professor, and here we are having a very similar moment, I think. And so it makes me balance, I think, that optimism with a sense that maybe we're running in circles.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. You said you see this in the context of history, and as you know, history is not one straight line of progress marching into the future. There are dead ends and there are detours. Looking back at Rodney King and further back, I know tonight you'll be talking about riots in Harlem as well. Where do you see us in that road toward progress?
Well, you know, I don't subscribe to the idea that, you know, history just goes in circles. It certainly also doesn't march in a straight line toward progress. And I wouldn't deny that that a lot has changed since 1992 when I was in college, and certainly since 1935, which is when what some people consider the first sort of modern urban riot took place in Harlem. It was sparked by rumors that a young black man was beaten after he was accused of shoplifting in a store in Harlem. And the mayor called for a massive investigation into this problem. The famous black sociologist E. Franklin Frazier was charged with studying the problem, and he came up with a very detailed report, and he concluded that the root of the problem was discrimination in jobs, lack of access to jobs, segregation, and police brutality. And he said, he pointed out that actually it wasn't the case that this young black man was actually beaten. It was just a rumor. But the experience of people living in Harlem had led them to believe that that type of rumor was very believable. It happened over and over and over again. So it didn't matter that in this case it actually hadn't happened. So in this particular case, I think, of racist violence, often by the police or by in some cases by private citizens in a sort of vigilante situation, similar to what we saw with the case in Florida a few years ago. We have these cases in which I think in some ways we haven't seen much progress, and we haven't seen over a very long time, we've seen these periodic outbursts over this type of behavior with very little actual success in addressing the problem.
And Deshaun, I want to go back to you. Just now, William said that he was torn between dismay and skepticism and hope, you know, elation, lots of different emotions about how to feel at this moment in time. And I wonder where you are on that spectrum, if you're optimistic moving forward, and where you'd like to see the movement, you know, even beyond Wisconsin and the UW campus, go next.
Well, I think I'm very similar in my emotions. I think a lot of people are with this current movement. Is we realize that this isn't something new, that historically there's been a lot of uprisings and protests of these similar things, and the policing of black bodies and things of that nature. So I think in the moments that we have, we are very hopeful, and you feel very powerful and optimistic to be standing with so many people that are supporting your cause and that want this progress to happen. But then we look to history and realize that we're in the same position that our forefathers were, you know, that people who came before us, they did the exact same thing in these same marches. So I think we're also at a point of trying to figure out what works best. Is it these protests? You know, is it peaceful movements? Is it violent movements? Like, where do we go from here? And I think that also translates into the Ferguson. A lot of them are painting as a leaderless movement. And you see things like Al Sharpton being booed off stage and people not happy that he's not letting the youth speak on these stages. So I think that's also a big shift. So that these monoliths from the past movements are not necessarily wanted to lead this one. And I think that's an important shift, too. And it all plays into people trying to figure out exactly what can work and what is worthwhile to pursue. As far as what I hope things to look like, I think that's a very, very large question to tackle. I think there's so many issues that we are currently fighting against, whether it be the police brutality or just the racism that you face every day. I think really what we're fighting for when it boils down to, we're just fighting for the right to be human and to be treated as such. We're not, and I think it's really interesting how people paint it as that we feel entitled or something, but we're really just, everything that America says that it stands for is what we are pursuing. And that's exactly what people are trying to stop us from getting. And I don't know, America's never been one to shy away from hypocrisy, and it continues to do so in these movements. So really, we want to be human in this country and treat it the same as everybody else. So a big first step with that is just opening everyone's eyes to their realities, you know, like things such as white privilege that people have such a hard time wrapping their heads around, and things of that nature. So we need to raise this awareness and get people to first understand that these issues exist and the different roles that everybody plays in them, so we can start to make progress.
We're talking right now with UW student Deshaun McKinney and UW professor Will Jones about the debate around Ferguson, race and law enforcement, and the protest movement that has sprung up around this. And we'd like you to join the conversation. What do you think about racial bias as you consider that and law enforcement in Wisconsin? How do you see these issues playing out in your community? And what can be done to overcome these problems and to move forward? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. We're talking now with UW professor Will Jones and UW student organizer Deshaun. I'm sorry, I don't have your last name. Deshaun McKinney is also here with us, talking about the national debate Ferguson ignited around law enforcement and race and how it's playing out here in Wisconsin. And we'd like to hear from you. What is your perception of law enforcement in the state? And as you consider this new national conversation about race issues and justice, where would you like to see the conversation go next? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Will, we're going to take it back through history a little bit more, actually looking at the context of immigration, going back to Japanese internment. How do you see things like the immigration issues that our country is grappling with today as being a piece of the puzzle when we talk about race and identity in America?
Well, I guess I think I see the problem that actually I think Deshaun kind of put his finger on, the question of belonging and citizenship, in the sense of whether there are certain people who are denied sort of basic principles of American citizenship, equal treatment before the law, due process, because of the color of their skin. I think in some ways the internment of Japanese Americans during the Second World War was one of the most pronounced sort of marked examples of the of this sort of denying of citizenship to people who were citizens, who simply based upon their skin color, their national background. And I think in many ways a lot of the discourse that we see around police brutality, the idea that it's okay to profile people because of the color of their skin, we see that in the immigration debate over that just recently, President Obama issued a prohibition on racial profiling, and he excluded the Border Patrol and the Immigration Service from that, again, on the idea that in some cases it's legitimate to deny people due process and their equal rights simply because of the way they look. And I think that sort of gets at the heart of this problem. And, of course, it's not only restricted to African Americans, but I think it goes to the way in which we treat people of color often.
And, well, part of the way this plays out is in through laws, through the changing of say, racial profiling laws. But there's also a conversation that we can have as a society. Where do you think this is most effectively addressed? With laws, with conversations, all of the above, what do you think is most effective when we consider social issues like this?
Well, like I said, I think the problem of police brutality is a very consistent problem. And I mean, if you look at, I mentioned the 1935 in Harlem, almost every instance of urban unrest in the 1960s was sparked by a case of police brutality. And I think one thing that I think we should need to really seriously contemplate is that one of the only effective responses to this in the 1960s was the position of the Black Panther Party, which was armed self-defense, in which they armed themselves and they patrolled communities specifically to keep police from attacking young Black people. I don't think that is a a response that many of us would like to see. In a sense, it's a vigilante response. But that actually was in the case of repeated efforts and calls to address this. This was in some ways a position that people were pushed into. And I think we, in terms of thinking about a response, I think we as a society have a responsibility to come up with other responses to this. But if people are victimized in that way, I think that's ultimately the way they respond.
And Deshaun, going back to your comments earlier about belonging, how you'd like to see inclusivity at the UW-Madison campus and not see it be a buzzword, but be something that really held change and brought change with it. Do you know what that would look like as you go about your day as a student here? What would that look like on campus?
Well, I think a big part of it is just the numbers on campus. I think that, I mean, the black population here is a little less than 3% out of 42,000. So we're a little over 1,200 students on campus. So I think something that people struggle with is they can go an entire day without seeing someone that looks like them. And I think that can be really, really tough for students. So just to get the enrollment numbers up and just to have those practices increased would be very helpful. I also would like to see the university support the people of color organizations on campus more. I know a lot of them that just don't get much funding or any funding at all sometimes, and they really have to scrap together their dollars to put their events on. And for a lot of people of color, these events are the only times like they want to be a part of university things, you know. So the larger university events, people don't feel that it relates to them. I know things such as like UHS, a lot of people don't feel like they're culturally competent, so they don't feel comfortable going there to take advantage of those services. And the same thing with a lot of other academic services on campus. So just the university starting to really reach across cultural lines and just start to understand the other students who make up this campus rather than just the majority of students who make up this campus is important.
And has that changed, do you think, within grasp right now, within a year? Do you see this as being something that could begin to change in the next, you know, maybe tomorrow? Or is this something that we're talking about years in terms of change?
I think overall it's something that's going to take time, but I think the change can start now, definitely. The university has this capacity to start implementing these changes now, and that is what we are going to start to do. I mean, even simple things. You think about the demonstration Sunday. We are currently pressuring the university to put it on its homepage on wish.edu. It's not one of the feature stories. And the university even tweeted itself that it's the largest movement since the Civil Rights Movement. So how could that not be a feature story on your homepage? And so just letting the university know you're taking a much more political stance by not putting it up than you are by putting it up. Because we're not asking them to take a side on it, just simply show what happened on your campus, because that's important and that's relevant. So things like that. See, for us to see that, that's us not feeling included in university. So just, I mean, steps like that can be taken now, and also just start to reach out more to these different organizations and things on campus and get us in the room to sit down and talk, actually connect with us and hear us out and what we need and what we want to see on campus.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us. And Will Jones, you'll be talking more about this tonight at this panel discussion at 5:30 at the Discovery Building on campus. Anything real quickly that you want to tell people you'll be talking about in particular?
Well, I think I'm going to be one of four professors, and so we'll be part of trying to bring some of our own scholarly background to some of these questions, whether they're historical or literary questions of political science. So I think it will be an interesting conversation. I also want to reiterate Deshaun's point about bringing students into this conversation, and I think that's really critical.
Well, thank you both for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Deshaun McKinney, UW student organizer, and William Jones, a professor of history at UW-Madison.